This is A Word, a podcast from Slate. I'm your host, Jason Johnson. Russia's invasion of Ukraine has dominated headlines and prompted several U.S. politicians, many of whom did not demonstrate any interest in this country before, to pressure President Biden to take stronger and stronger action. But the crisis is also highlighting how race and ethnicity changes the response to war and the refugees struggling to escape it.
It was interesting watching reporters who were bending over backwards to help their viewers understand that there was really something different about this moment in Europe.
More on the stakes in the Ukrainian crisis coming up on A Word with me, Jason Johnson. Stay with us. Welcome to A Word, a podcast about race and politics and everything else. I'm your host, Jason Johnson. It has been more than a generation since most Americans viewed Russia as an existential threat. But since Russian President Vladimir Putin launched an invasion of neighboring Ukraine, the U.S. and much of Europe has seen Cold War-era tensions and fears of global war come roaring back. Here in the U.S., the conflict has many leaders and citizens asking what more we should do for Ukraine, and others asking whether or not this is our fight at all. Joining us for more perspective is Patrick Gaspard. He's a former ambassador to South Africa and the current president and chief executive officer of the Center for American Progress. Ambassador, welcome to A Word.
Jason, thank you so very much for having me on your fantastic show.
On Sunday, you tweeted this: "There are no heroes in war. History and poetry are liars. Some who take up arms to strike back, some who gather and run to borders, all without choice as the heel crushes." What inspired you to share that?
You know, I was watching the coverage of the tragic circumstances in Ukraine, comparing the coverage that I was watching of this challenge to the coverage that we've seen in places like Afghanistan, Syria, et cetera, but Afghanistan in particular with the recent U.S. pullout, and the way journalists, American journalists, described Afghanis in that moment, talked about people who weren't standing and fighting as the Taliban took over their country, described them in very unheroic terms, despite right. the fact that they've been involved in a 20-year clash to preserve their democratic spaces, to protect spaces for women and girls to learn and to advance. And I contrasted that with the kind of coverage that I've been seeing out of the Ukraine, which is entirely not just glowing, but there's a hagiography that begins to develop about who these people are versus people in other conflict zones. And there's a suggestion in it almost, the subtext as well, these are folks that are worth standing up for, as opposed to those who are fleeing from other spaces. Whereas, you know, you and I know, of course, that there are millions of Ukrainians who have already left their country, and they had no choice in what they were doing because right. they were under the same kind of siege that Syrians were under previously, that Afghanis were under, but they're described differently and received differently. That is not a suggestion at all, Jason, that they should not be received warmly. That is not a suggestion that one should be critical of those who pick up arms to defend their nation. But I just think that there are lenses that we put on these spaces that reduce the humanity of some and over-elevate the status of others.
It's one thing for Americans and the American press and some American politicians to basically say, oh, look at this country of relatively white people that look like our neighbors, quote unquote, what a tragedy this is, and sort of dismiss and dehumanize Afghanistan and Syria and Yemen and Haiti. But what's been fascinating to me is to see similar attitudes in European countries, many of whom are very hostile to refugees, even other white refugees. I mean, you know, if you look at what was happening in the Balkans, there wasn't necessarily open arms for people fleeing Yugoslavia. There weren't necessarily open arms for people fleeing Serbia. But for some reason, there seems to be that attitude now, even in certain countries that in the past weren't so open. Why do you think that attitude has changed within Europe?
Lots of factors at play there. One thing I will say about Poland's response, and Poland is really the most interesting one to look at because the leadership in Poland has been hostile to refugees, to amnesty seekers. has used rhetoric about terrorists and people who aren't like us. You know, there are definitely cultural bonds between Ukrainians and the Polish that's, you know, altogether different than the relationships that they have with others in Europe. And of course, there's the response to hostility that's not civil war, but is the antagonism of a superpower like Russia against a much smaller state. And clearly, if you look at Poland in particular and Hungary, long history of Soviet hostilities, Russian antagonism, that one can appreciate why they would respond differently to refugees who were fleeing the might of the Russian state. That being said, Jason, it's really interesting to listen keenly and closely to the rhetoric from leaders like Viktor Orban in Hungary or Kaczynski in Poland, who go out of their way to say things like, well, these are not like the refugees we've seen before. These are educated right. people. These are people who are contributing to society. And that's why we're able to receive them, which, you know, begs a question about how they view the humanity, the significance, the importance of human beings from Syria, Afghanistan, et cetera, who don't look like them, who don't speak their language, but who are fleeing similarly difficult circumstances. I think it's very interesting to listen to the rhetoric in the U.S. From our Congress, from our media. To go back to the question of who is heroic and who is not, Jason, you know, I appreciate the reception that the leader of Ukraine, Zelensky, has received from our Congress. It is right and good that we rally to the support of Ukrainians, but that stands in certainly stark contrast to the treatment of others. You mentioned Haitians before. Wasn't that many months ago that I found myself at the border of at the Del Rio border in Texas, where, mm-hmm. of course, we saw Haitian migrants and amnesty seekers being receiving the most horrific reception from our border patrol, who were on horses, who were lashing out on them with the reins of those horses. We saw COVID being used by this country as a way to deny legitimate amnesty processes to those who are fleeing dire, dire circumstances in Haiti, where a president has been assassinated, where there's political mafia state violence in the streets that make even our embassy staffers feel unsafe and need to be protected. So real contrast in how we talk about these spaces and our own sphere of influence here and how we receive these folk.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, more on Ukraine. This is A Word with Jason Johnson. Stay tuned. This is Jason Johnson, host of A Word, Slate's podcast about race and politics and everything else. I want to take a moment to welcome our new listeners. If you've discovered A Word and like what you hear, please subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen to podcasts. And let us know what you think by writing us at aword@slate.com. Thank you.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to A Word with Jason Johnson. Today, we're talking with Patrick Gaspard of the Center for American Progress about Ukraine. We have these stories about African students not being able to flee and they're being stopped at the border, or they get out of Ukraine and they go to Poland, or they try to go to Slovakia, they try to go to these other countries, and they're told you can't come in. Is this something that the United States is trying to address as we consider sending more arms to the Ukraine? Is this something that European countries are trying to address, or has the sort of mistreatment of Black refugees during this crisis been overlooked in favor of, you know, praise of the bravery of the Ukrainian people?
I'd say this. I think that it's been clearly expressed by Secretary of State Anthony Blinken, by Vice President Kamala Harris, by our NSC, by our United Nations representative, Linda Thomas Greenfield, clear expressions of concern and support for those who are studying, who are working in the Ukraine, who are from the Global South, and the images that we've seen of how they're being treated. So expressions of concerns, questions have been asked about that treatment, and there have been attempts made to extend support to those fleeing students and those fleeing workers. So that is definitely the case. Though I will say, Jason, that the United States, as a consequence of decisions that were made by the Trump administration, really currently is receiving abysmally low numbers of political refugees into the U.S. And there's a stark contrast to the numbers that are being received transmitted through Europe now. Our refugee system, our amnesty system, was completely upended by the Trump administration, and it's taking some time to really put it back together again. I'm going to pull back a little further on your question about the U.S. response, Jason, just to point out that I think that the kind of all of agency response that we've seen from the Biden administration is absolutely commendable and stands in stark contrast to the bromance that we saw between Donald Trump and President Putin. This administration sounded early alarms, rallied allies in Europe to help strengthen both the EU and NATO through this crisis, and have really dropped a curtain of sanctions on Russia, the likes of which we have not seen before. And in a very short time, they managed to isolate Putin and turn Russia into a pariah state. And that needs to be contrasted by your listeners, Jason, to the kind of applause that we've seen in some conservative circles, certainly on Fox News, and from those who continue to prop up Donald Trump. Contrast that with how they have celebrated Vladimir Putin. They have lifted up what they consider to be his strength versus the weaknesses of Democratic leaders in this country. And everyone should recall, of course, that Trump's campaign guru was Paul Manafort, a man who worked for the pro-Russian president of Ukraine and altered the platform of the Republican National Convention in order to deny security support to the Ukraine. And that Donald Trump's very impeachment was about how he denied support to Zelensky in an attempt to compel him to use his very offices to support Trump's campaign against Joe Biden. We cannot forget that ever in how we think about the current U.S. response versus what the likely response would have been for Trump, even as you and I unpack the important questions of refugee status and the distinctions that are being made between Ukrainians fleeing warfare and those from the Global South who have been treated radically differently.
I want to go back to this idea of how the last, I guess, three administrations have dealt with Ukraine. When you were in the Obama administration, you were there in the 2014 sort of revolution where the pro-Russian leadership was removed from Ukraine. You were also there when the Russians invaded and sort of advanced and took hold of the Crimea. Looking back on what your experiences were in the administration, do you think we could have predicted what was happening now? Was this sort of inevitable, regardless of who was in office? Or do you think there's something unique about the years under Trump and these first year under Biden that has made Vladimir Putin more aggressive?
You're right, of course, that it was during the Obama administration that we saw a change of leadership in the Ukraine. I want to be really careful in how we talk about that, because we should all understand that that was a regime change that was spurred by the Ukrainian people themselves, who were marching in the streets, who were demonstrating, and basically made the space ungovernable because they had leadership that curried favor with Russia, that just did the bidding of Vladimir Putin, and they refuse to be governed under those terms. You are also right in your assessment of what happened in Crimea during the Obama administration. I think you're right to ask the question about whether or not all of this was inevitable. I would say this. If you've paid any attention to Vladimir Putin over the course of the last 14 years, you realize that both in his public pronouncements and in how he has deployed Russia's military in an open way and under disguise as well, it's been very clear that he's had designs on this territory for some time. I believe that the efforts that Russia made successful, I would say successful efforts to intervene in the 2016 election between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton was absolutely connected to his future aspirations around this geography, and that the defeat of Donald Trump in the last election made it clear to him that he no longer had an ally in the Oval Office in the United States. And if he was going to destabilize Europe, destabilize NATO, he would, in his vision, have to seize this land directly because he no longer had a president in the White House who would just cede it to him.
I want to ask about this before we sort of turn into domestic politics. One of the criticisms that you hear, we have the far right who have said, oh, you know, the Tucker Carlson, Zelensky is terrible and they're so bad and they've got, you know, Nazis. But what I've also been experiencing and have seen a lot of is the sort of the American anti-imperialist far left who make this argument that essentially Russia was baited into this war, that the United States was going to somehow put Ukraine into NATO and that Russia had no choice. When you hear those kinds of arguments from the far left in the United States, what is your response to that? What is your response to this idea that Russia had no choice and that America is really the bad guy in this sort of Ukrainian invasion?
It's nonsensical. It's actually rather tragic. It's poor assessment, little understanding of the history of the region. But it's not just the far left in the United States who are guilty of this. Look at, you know, the and I say this with real profound respect for its leadership, but I think that arguments like this are also made by leadership in non-aligned countries like South Africa, where I had the greatest honor to serve. South Africa has a special relationship with Russia, given the support that it received from Russia during the apartheid period. However, that relationship should not obscure the obligation that nations like South Africa have to protect and promote democracy and human rights around the world, both of which the Russians are in violation of. As far as the left in this country, I want to be clear about something, Jason. I am sympathetic to the, and I'm in solidarity with their instinct of skepticism. To look at these kinds of interventions and to listen to the war hawking that we're hearing from some and to say, wait a second here, let's slow down. We've had other moments where we've had false flag operations, where we've received information about weapons of mass destruction. There is a history that the U.S. has, where the U.S. has not respected sovereignty or rights. However, the notion that Vladimir Putin is in the Ukraine now because he was baited by NATO is just is beyond nonsensical. Putin has been making incursions into these spaces for some time. And it's also been clear, really clear, Jason, that NATO has kept the Ukraine at arm's length. They've had many opportunities to embrace Ukraine, grant Ukraine membership, and they've been clear that they were not, that was not the trajectory. They were not moving in that direction. So there's no reason whatsoever to give justification to this argument from this dictator, this violent, brutal dictator, Vladimir Putin, as it relates to NATO. There's nothing in the history. There's nothing in the practical steps that were taken by NATO nations towards Ukraine that would be suggestive of this whatsoever.
We're going to take a short break. We come back more with former Ambassador Patrick Gaspard about U.S. policy in Ukraine. This is A Word with Jason Johnson. Stay tuned. I've got a special message for our listeners in Canada. It's about a show that I think you should listen to. Canada Land. Every week, Canada Land's journalists bring you news and conversations that honestly can be hard to find these days. With rigorous reporting and thoughtful analysis, their episodes bring you into the most important conversations from across the country. From a radical form of reconciliation emerging in Saskatchewan to in-depth debates and gun rights and the rise of fascism, Canada Land's stories will surprise you and make you think. Try Canada Land today and find out why Canadian news doesn't have to sound like Canadian news. Search Canada Land in your podcast app. You're listening to A Word with Jason Johnson. Today we're talking with Ambassador Patrick Gaspard about the crisis in Ukraine. There's a lot happening in domestic politics in the United States. We're dealing with the COVID crisis. We're dealing with high gas prices. We're dealing with an ongoing attempted insurrection being covered over by many Republicans in Congress. And this current crisis in Ukraine is putting pressure on Democratic leadership. After the multi-billion dollar COVID package failed in Congress, a couple of weeks ago, Speaker Nancy Pelosi had this exchange with reporter Jake Sherman at a press conference.
I just want to dig into that a little bit more on the COVID relief
package. This will be your third time.
My third time, what, asked about COVID relief?
Yeah.
Well, it's substantive. You like substantive questions, so I just want to make sure.
Yeah, well, people are dying in Ukraine and all of that, yeah.
People are dying from COVID, too.
Do you think that the United States government has done a good job communicating to the American people? I mean, yes, the polls have suggested that most people don't like what Russia is doing. But do you think the U.S. government has done a good job communicating why we're trying to put together packages to help Ukraine, why this issue matters, even as we have ongoing crises at home? Because, you know, during a midterm year, if it appears as though the government is too distracted to take care of real concerns on the ground, that could have dire consequences for the current administration.
I'm often critical of poor narrative, poor storytelling, poor communications on a number of fronts. I think that there's been a struggle to communicate the essence, for instance, of the Build Back Better bill, which led to its failure. But I'm going to give the Biden administration lots of credit here, Jason. I think if you look at the support that this administration is receiving from not just Democrats, but from independents, from Republicans as well, for the defense of democracy, defense of the people of Ukraine, there's overwhelming support. And that comes out of the president kind of freezing us all in the moment, hitting the pause button on all of the other crises that all of us are dealing with in our lives, and helping us to kind of pull up to the fireside and to give us some context for what is occurring in the Ukraine, why it is in keeping with the frame that he has laid up from his campaign to now about autocracy versus democracy, why that has direct implications for our future here in the U.S. He's connected this very clearly to the kind of dependencies that we have on fossil fuel and all that we have to do to relieve ourselves of those dependencies in the future so that we're not dependent, not just on Russia, but on other other autocratic regimes for crude oil. I think that the president has also made it clear every step of the way here that the sanctions that we're imposing on Russia are going to have implications here in the U.S. as it relates to the contribution that they make to overall inflation. And he's asked Americans to be prepared to endure that a bit longer in order to preserve and protect the rights of people to live freely who are being literally bombed out of their homes by Russia. So I think that the president has landed the context and has expanded the kind of scope of solidarity here in this make or break moment, despite the fact that we have an entire network in this country that continues to really shill for Vladimir Putin. It's reprehensible what's happening on that network. But fortunately, it seems as if the American people appreciate what's really at stake.
So at the moment that this episode airs, Friday, President Biden will be in Poland to talk with European allies about the next steps in Ukraine. If you were still in the White House, if you were advising him, what would you be telling him to say?
Well, I think that the very first thing that the president needs to do is to double down on the very, very strong work that I've already commended him for, which is the work of creating a space for Europe itself to lead in this challenge. I think that the president needs to reinforce in Poland to European allies the fact that the U.S. Has already, in this past week alone, committed an additional $1 billion in military aid to Ukraine, reaching $2 billion since last January, that our Congress passed a $13.6 billion Ukraine supplemental funding bill with billions of assistance, despite resistance from some corners, and that Europe itself needs to continue to press the case by maintaining maximum military pressure on Vladimir Putin and Russia through its military assistance to the Ukraine. There's lots of it seems as if every member of Congress here and every news correspondent has suddenly become an expert in weaponry. Everyone's calling for MiGs and missile-to-air defense. I think that the Ukrainians have demonstrated that the material that they've received from the U.S. and from European leadership has been sufficient to slow down and thwart the Russian advance. It's very clear that Russia is not going to be able to just kind of march into Kiev the way that they had anticipated. So President Biden has to continue to rally European allies to moving support, direct military support to Ukrainians. But then beyond that, Jason, I think it's really important that they step up to the next level of tough sanctions regime. If you look at what's happened in London, it's really kind of astonishing to see how London has become a money laundering center for autocrats. It's really an astonishing thing. And there are measures that Boris Johnson could take, that other Europeans could take, that would continue to choke off resources to those who support Putin's war in a way that could further isolate Putin's leadership and increase the likelihood that the oligarchs in his country pressure him to negotiate, to pull out, to resolve this crisis with the Ukraine.
You are a big comic book fan. When we look at the Ukrainian crisis in the fairest, most comic booky way possible, are there clear good guys and bad guys? Are there heroes and supervillains in this conflict that we could all understand?
You know, the good guys and gals are the people who, without any provocation whatsoever, have had their lives upended by the Russian state and by Vladimir Putin's ambitions. We have innocent men, women, children who went to bed one night with the same kinds of dreams and ambitions that you and I have for our families, for our communities, for our children, and woke up to a nightmare where their homes no longer existed, where they had no access to fundamentals, electricity, running water, the ability to feed their families, and instead had to gather up all of whatever they could of their worldly possessions and of their families, and either flee to borders, and in some cases, not just flee to borders, but to abandon their families and return to take up arms against those who unprovoked, have violated norms and basic standards of humanity. Those are the good guys and gals of this comic book story, if you will, Jason, and those who rally to their defense, rally to the notion that one should not be able to violate sovereignty like this, shouldn't be able to violate democratic spaces in this violent way. Those are some of the good guys and gals as well. And the villain clearly here is Vladimir Putin and those who support Vladimir Putin's violence, his excursion into the Ukraine, his grand designs for the world, and those who every day lift up illiberal autocratic practice as if that should be the norm for all of us.
Patrick Gaspard is the former U.S. Ambassador to South Africa and the President and CEO of the Center for American Progress. Thank you so much for joining me today on A Word.
Thank you, my brother. Appreciate you.
And that's A Word for this week. The show's email is aword@slate.com. This episode was produced by Jasmine Ellis. Alicia Montgomery is the executive producer of podcasts at Slate. June Thomas is senior managing producer of the Slate Podcast Network. Our theme music was produced by Don Will. I'm Jason Johnson. Tune in next week for A Word.